Maybe I'll move to the center. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Okay. Now it makes me really feel uncomfortable. Please, absolutely. I've changed the entire logistics.
Better now than later, right? Thank you very much. Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. And I have to say that after such an introduction, I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say. I would be remiss. Firstly, I do want to thank Mayor Vollman for inviting me to speak this evening. We'll get to that in a moment. But I also, it would be remiss for me not to mention your tremendous Rav leader of this community, Rabbi Beller, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And I will tell you that I did not know him personally. I, of course, knew him by reputation. But I will say this, that a few weeks, unfortunately, before he was diagnosed, we had been in conversation. We were talking to each other a number of times. And he was trying, in terms of my kibbutz programs, trying to implement a bar and bat mitzvah program here in Ranana that he was going to help me connect with, and I also was engaged in conversation with him and having him become one of our lecturers for Makom Meshutaf. Unfortunately, that was not to be, but certainly the seeds that he has planted, both in his beautiful family and in the work that he's done in this community and Eretz Yisrael at large, lives on. And I think the greatest way that we can preserve his memory is certainly to learn Torah. Yehi zichro baruch, we should know besarot tovot, and he should serve as a melitz yosher for you, for your kehillah, for your families, for his family, and for the broader family, as we have to see it, of Am Yisrael. I would also be remiss, Dr. Gordon mentioned, I know them also very well, and they're lovely people, and they just made a most wonderful steak dinner for me, which will explain why I'm going to fall asleep while I'm speaking. But I would be remiss for me because what was mentioned by Dr. Gordon is that I have one of my svarim, the newest book, which was put out by Koren Publishing, outside for sale. And this is not just a promo, but I must mention that my dear friends, David and Mava Samuels, who are connected to this kehillah, obviously, through their kids, which is also the way it should be, but I feel a personal connection here in Ranana, they have helped sponsor that book. So without their kindness and contributions and generosity, much of my work would not be possible. So I thank them very much for that support as well. We'll start off by saying the following. It's a cliche, and that is that I have this evening to impart to you both some good news and some bad news. Let's start off with the bad news. The reason why I was invited to speak to you here this evening is because Mayor Vollman, and it could be that he was the only one, came across an article of mine that I wrote about a month and a half ago in the summer. It was in the Jerusalem Post, and it was about datlashim, which in Hebrew means dati l'she'avar, past tense, past observant people. And I wrote an article in which I theorized why exactly it happens, and it's something that disturbs me greatly, and so on and so forth. And he apparently got hold of the article, might be one of the only few, and he decided to invite me to speak here this evening. And that's the only reason why I'm speaking to you. I am not an expert in this subject. In fact, I'm not sure that I even have that many great insights to offer you this evening because I don't consider myself an expert in this subject. That's the bad news. The good news is that we can now blame Mayer for inviting me to speak to you this evening. But having said that, I think that the reason why I agreed to come this evening is because I have to tell you, this subject, it burns inside of me. It is a subject that consistently disturbs me. I almost would not exaggerate were I to say yomam v'layla. I am constantly challenged with trying to figure out where it is coming from that Orthodox or observant children, both, by the way, in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox world, it's just not as publicized because it's far more insular community and is ghettoized, but it exists there, and certainly in the Dati Lumi, i.e., however you want to call it, modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, religious Zionist Orthodox, whatever, that's a talk for another time. But however you want to call it, it is very, very imminent. and prevalent. And like an infectious disease, I believe that it's spreading rampantly. And it bothers me tremendously. So much so that virtually every Shabbat, I sit around my Shabbat table with our seven children. Yes, I'll include my son-in-law as one of our six, so it's seven. I never know if he gets a hold of this recording. And now, Baruch Hashem, 4 weeks ago, our newly born granddaughter, she doesn't add much to the conversation at this point, but we discuss, and I drive my kids crazy, because I tell them that I found out in our neighborhood that there's another kid who's not religious, who's not observant, and they know what's coming, and they say, Abba, don't, and I can't control myself. Every Shabbat, I consistently say, why? Why is it happening? Where is it coming from? What are the dynamics? What have we done wrong that this disease continues to fester? And the truth is that when you look at the issue of Datlashim, there was a book that was published in 2011 by a woman named Poria Gal Getz. She's a reporter for newspapers, and she is a Datlashit. In fact, her grandfather was Rav Getz, who was the Rav of the Kotel in Yerushalayim, and she's no longer religious, she's left it. But she continues to insist that she believes in God, which is another phenomenon that's very interesting. It makes it even more challenging to deal with. But having said that, she says in her book, which was published in 2011, that she believes 20% of the modern Orthodox Dati Leumi world here in Eretz Yisrael are Datlashim. And I believe that she's wrong. I believe the percentage is much higher since 2011. And one of the fascinating things that she says there is that she's done research and she brings up examples of various people from various walks of life, i.e. politics, army, education, rabbis, who have gone, as we call it, off the derech, who have rejected their religious observance. And she asks, is it a philosophical issue by nature? Are there things that are bothering them theologically? And her answer is, I don't know. She doesn't know. She theorizes, but she doesn't have a consistent theory or consistent formula for successfully understanding, comprehending where and when and why all of this comes from. And it's truly remarkable. And the truth is, when you think about it, it becomes extremely frustrating. But truth be told, there is no one answer. How can there be one answer as to why there are Datlashim in this world? How can there be, think about it, how absurd posing a theory would be to say that this is why people go off the derech. After all of you know, no two people are the same. Family dynamics play a role in it. Community dynamics, rabbinic dynamics, education, the roles of various people who may have affected them at different points and different junctures of their lifetime certainly plays a role. So how is it possible for me to pin down this markedly difficult issue on one particular item or thing that causes this entire problem to exist? I think that's virtually impossible, because everyone comes from different walks of life and everyone has different experiences. But there are all kinds of theories in terms of why people become Datlashim. There are those who will say that it's an issue of parenting. Poor parenting. Really? Well, I could tell you that. I mean, I don't see what happens behind closed doors in everyone's house, but I know some very, what seem to be very fine, religiously sincere, honest, integrity people who have children who have gone off the derech, who are not religious, who are not observant anymore. Not only that, they don't believe in God. I know them personally. They come to my house. I schmooze with them on a consistent basis as well to understand and comprehend where they're coming from. And they won't talk to their parents about it, but they do talk to me. And these are kids who come from fine, sincere, religiously observant families, and they do not fast on Yom Kippur. Ad kedei kach. And they do not believe in God. So, go figure. Is it the issue of the family? There are those who say that it is down or boils down to philosophical, unsettled issues whereby people have theological contradictions that fester or that disturb them in their lives, and they can't figure out the answers to these problems. It's possible, but I've met many Dadlashim who say that they've had fascinating conversations and very strong arguments with regards to God's existence and embracing God's law, and yet they just choose not to be observant, even though they come from a strong religious observant family. And then there's also even the theory that it's just potluck. Roll the dice. I mean, who knows? We have six kids. You know, I hold my breath every night I go to sleep. I sit up 3 o'clock in the morning. My wife rolls over. She says, "What's going on? Why are you up?" I say, "I'm worried." So she says, "So why are you telling me?" I said, "I need you to worry with me." "What are you worried about?" "Well, I'm worried. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I've got one kid who's married, but I've got five more. One's in the army. Two are in the army. I got a daughter in Tzali. I got a son in Nachal Brigade with all Chilonim, all secular Jews, secular from kibbutzim. And I'm worried. What's going to be? So tell me, I'm going to educate them and discuss with them and be a concerned Abba and give them answers to the problems, to the questions, to the innuendos that they might encounter in various walks of life. But there's no guarantee. So what do you do?" So there really is no one answer. And those of you who came, and there might be some of you, and I don't need to know, there might be some of you who have come because you have children who are not observant anymore. I'm sorry to disappoint you. I don't have an answer for you. And I may not even have such wonderful advice to give you with regards to how to, certainly not how to bring them back, and with regards to how to deal with this point of contention. But what I'm going to share with you this evening, because otherwise you'd be saying to yourself, "Well, why the heck are you here?" That's a good question. The water's good. What I'm going to share with you this evening are insights from the Torah and Chazal. And I will tell you this, and it's fascinating, because even Chazal, you'll see in some of the literature that I will read to you, even Chazal make it clear and say boldly, this is not a guarantee. There's no guarantee that if you follow these guidelines that everything's going to be peachy cream. But I will tell you this. Chazal and the Torah believed that if you don't follow these guidelines, your chances of failure are greater. Everyone got that? Because I want it to be clear. Because I don't want anyone to come over to me afterwards and say, "Rabbi, come on, give me something. You know, I mean, I came for an instant pill. You know, give me something that's going to make my kids religious or guarantee." I don't have it. And neither did Chazal, and neither does the Torah. But Chazal have formulas where they say, if you don't follow the following guidelines, chances are greater that there will be failure. It's important to note as well, I personally and very anti-self-help things. And by the way, it's interesting because I'm on the speaker circuit, and thank God I'm a fantastic speaker, so I get booked. But that was just a joke. Everyone's looking at me like, "No, go an extra hour. What's the problem?" So I'm on the speaker circuit, and I noticed that many of the topics that people speak about are self-help. How to be a greater parent, how to have a successful marriage, how to fall in love, how to nurture kindness in the world. Give me a break. I don't believe in any of that stuff. I don't believe in those self-help books. I don't believe in these lecturers who go around, because the truth is, I mean, it's funny, because you look at some of these lecturers, they have like the worst family situations, you know. They're like broken marriages, and their kids are rebellious, and their kids are on drugs. I mean, whatever it is that's going on, they got all kinds of issues, but yet they're telling everyone in the world how to self-help themselves. You know what? Let's start at home, and then you can go out and preach. So I'm not one of those kind of people. I never wrote books on that stuff, and I don't subscribe to that stuff, because I don't believe that anyone has the right to say that I'm an expert in parenting. I don't think it exists. In fact, I will go further to say that anyone who says that they are an expert in parenting probably have serious problems in parenting. Because if you and I know that parenting is the most challenging job in the world, And what's amazing is Rabbi Wein used to say this to us. He used to say, you know, boys, I don't really understand, he used to say. We need a license for every single thing. You need a license to drive. You need a license to drink alcohol. You need a license to sell alcohol. You need a license to practice medicine. You need a license to practice law. But you don't need a license to be a parent. I mean, anyone can become a parent at any particular time of their lives to as many kids as they want. And you think to yourself, that is the most difficult job in the world, and yet there's free license. Have as many kids as you want, whatever you want, and you're thinking, like, I don't get it. And the truth is that there should be a parenting license. There should be parenting schools. And the reason why there isn't is because if we went to train ourselves how it is to be a parent, no one would have kids. So it's the Lord's sense of humor. Having said that, I want to share with you the following insights. Our daughter and son-in-law just had as I mentioned them a few moments ago, 4 weeks old, our granddaughter. I said, Toda, thank you. I said to my son-in-law, I said to him, look, you've now become a parent. There's one keta, one perush, one commentary on the Torah that you should read as a parent. There's a lot of things you should read, of course. I mean, but there's one outstanding commentary that I would say is required reading for a parent. And it is the perush of the Rashar Hirsch, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who talks about the child rearing, or lack of it thereof, of Yitzchak and Rivka. And the Torah tells us, it's an unbelievable thing, if you look at the beginning of Parshat Toldot, the Torah describes the experience of Yitzchak and Rivka. Now we're talking about here the second forefather, the pillar, the paramount of God, the prototype of belief in monotheism, the follower of Avraham Avinu. Who greater? Who holier? Who could hold the greatest example possible of someone who would succeed, at least, in preserving spirituality, religiosity in his home? Forget about all of the thousands of people that he's going out and bringing closer to the fold and involved in this horrible world called Kiruv. And yet he does it, but in his own home, Yitzchak has a Yaakov, and Yitzchak and Rivka have an Esav. And nobody's going to come and tell me that Yitzchak and Rivka, you know, they said to Esav, so you're not too observant. Just do what you want, you know, but we'll just invest in Yaakov. They're twins. They were raised the same exact way. They were brought to the same schools. They were given the same tools. They were sent to the same chugim. They were dressed the same way. They had the same dress code. They had the same eating habits. They had the same schedules. And that, my friend, says Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, was the problem. It's an amazing insight. And he says, if you look at the Torah, when it reveals that after Rivka goes through the discourse with God and is blessed with having these twins, immediately afterwards, it says, right after we find out that she's expecting children, Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, Vayehi Esav ish yodea tzayet ish sadev Yaakov ish tam yoshev oalim. The children grow up. Says Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, excuse me, there's a big chapter that's skipped in the middle of the discourse of the Torah, and that is, how'd they grow up? What happened all the years when they were children? That it doesn't say. And Rav Hirsch says the reason why the Torah doesn't say it, there's a method to its madness. It is revealing the fact that their childhood was ignored. They were not given, they were not privy to a proper upbringing as children. And he says even further, it's a tremendous thing. He demonstrates that parents have to be sensitive to their particular child's needs. And we know that from the Pasuk in Mishlei. Chanoch lena'ar al pi darko. Educated child. There's no one way to educate a child. My rabbi used to say to us, Alavai, there should be a yeshiva for every single kid by himself. Right? Every kid needs his own yeshiva. It doesn't work. It doesn't happen. But in theory, it would be wonderful. because every child's different. Chanoch lenar al pidarko. And Yitzchak and Rivka, says Rav Hirsch, did not subscribe and did not understand the boundaries of what that guideline is. And it's an unbelievable thing. He says like this, I quote you, Hamoshiv et Yaakov ve'et Esav al safsal limudim echad. A person who takes Jacob and Esau and sits them down on the same bench to study, muvtach lo she'et echad mehem mekalkel. He's guaranteed that he's ruined at least one of his children. Why? Because in our day, we all know that were we to encounter a character called Esav, we would immediately take him to the neurologist. We would get him the biggest dosage of Ritalin possible. He would be diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, which apparently permeates 75% of the population of this world. And we would immediately know that this is a kid who needs, you know, a special needs, or he needs a kita mekademet, or he needs a kita telem, or all the other things, all the other wonderful inventions that we have in there that don't necessarily solve the problem, but at least we put them inside a category. And Esav would fit one of those categories. And we're Esav privileged to have Ritalin and to go through 5,000 shekels a month of tests that we have to run for these kids to figure out what we already know to begin with. It might have been a very different story. But, says Rav Hirsch, Yitzchak and Rivka were not attuned to the needs of an Esav. Esav was a physical person. Esav was good at sports. He wasn't good at academia. He needed to prove himself in the gymnasium. He needed to prove himself in the art chug. He needed to prove himself in the music chug. He needed to prove himself in a different type of school that are popping up right, left, and center in this country, because we're all realizing that there are kids like that. And says Rav Hirsch, if you put him on this chair in the Beis Medrash to study Torah all day, you're doomed for failure. And they didn't recognize that. And they failed as parents. Let us not underestimate the failure of what happened here in not being able to child rear and nurture Esav. That partly was the fault of Rivka and Yitzchak. Not only that, says Rav Hirsch, a tremendous insight. He says that Yitzchak and Rivka essentially were living their own lives vis-a-vis their children. In other words, where did Rivka come from? Rivka came from a house of Lavan, a house that embraced Avodah Zarah, idolatry. She came from a house of promiscuity. She came from a house that was materialistic. So what did Rivka look for in her child? Oh, I'm going to live my own spiritual dream through my son. And therefore she loved and preferred the character of Yaakov more. Because Yaakov was someone who could sit and learn, and he could study, and he could become an outstanding scholar, and he would become this spiritual essential being. And Rivka said, that's my boy. But when she looked at Esav, she said, he's reminding me of exactly what I was when I was a kid, and not for me. And then we look at Yitzchak. Yitzchak was brought up in a sheltered atmosphere, in a place where his father, who is someone who's makariv the whole world, and his father was the Rosh Yeshiva, and he was brought up in the Beit Midrash, and Yitzchak, to a certain extent, might very well have been extremely frustrated by the fact that he lived in the shadow of his father, which, by the way, classically, is why children of rabbis are never as good as the rabbi. Because many times, or rarely, because many times the child is just brought up in the shadow of the rabbi. So no matter what the kid does, everybody walks around saying, well, you know, he's not as good as his father. I remember his father. And that's very difficult for a child to deal with. Here's Yitzchak, and he's dealing with the exact same thing. Wherever Yitzchak goes, nobody knows the guy's name. Nobody calls him Yitzchak. Everyone calls him Abi's son. He's Avram's child. And therefore he goes through an identity crisis. And the means or the way that he is to live out his life that he would have liked to get out of this exclusive atmosphere, to get out of this restrictive atmosphere, is vis-a-vis Esav. And therefore he loves Esav more. Because Esav is the guy who rebels. Esav is the guy who goes out. He's having a good time. He's a hunter. He's into the physicality. He's a gymnast. Oh, that's something that I could have used in my childhood. And therefore, he too lives what he was lacking in his childhood through his son, Esav. And says Rav Hirsch, we are never allowed to live our lives through our children. We're never allowed to live our lives, what we had hoped in our lives, through our children. Because that is doomed to failure. And he says, it's an unbelievable thing. He says, on the other hand, Yaakov, Jacob, our forefather, who was privy to learn from the mistakes of the parenting of his parents, has the ability to sit on his bed, on his deathbed, surrounded by 12 sons, and to look at every single one and give every single one a different blessing. Because Yaakov knows very well, no two sons are the same. This guy will be good at art. This guy will be good at music. This guy will be good at learning. This guy will be good at philosophy. This guy will be good at math. This one will be good at law, and so on and so forth. The academics, and this one, it's all, and that's what he understood. And therefore, says Rav Hirsch, a tremendous thing. Amad Sham, when he's offering the brachot to his children. Amad Sham, the neged einav ha'am kulo. In front of Jacob stands the entire nation. Im al kos gulotav harav gevaniot. The entire nation stands in front of him in all of their talents. And this is what Jacob understands. And therefore he's able to offer a bracha to each and every one's persona. The greatest bracha is the fact that Yaakov at this particular moment rectifies to a certain extent the mistake of Yitzchak and Rivka, which boils down to one thing only. The lack of communication with their children. And Yaakov has that, and Yitzchak and Rivka were lacking in their ability to communicate with their children. And that's exactly why. And again, please do not take this in any way that I am suggesting that I'm a perfect parent. I am far, far from it. And if you don't believe me, ask my kids. But one thing that we do, one thing that I know, that I believe I'm doing right, nay, a Shabbat table goes by whereby we do not sit on Shabbat Friday night and discuss at least one heated issue. Many times, it's the issue of Datlashim. But I just bring up crazy topics that I want to hear their opinions about. And there's big machloket at the table. And my son, who's coming from Atzmona, doesn't see the same way as my daughter who's in Bar Ilan. And even my little son, you know, he sticks one thing or two in there. Everyone's got a different way of seeing things, but I don't care. If we're engaged in conversation, if we're communicating, if we're arguing healthily, then for me, that's a good thing. And I'll give you an example. Listen to how wacko I am. One Friday night, this is only a few weeks ago, Friday night, I was in shul, and I started to think, right, because you don't expect to go to shul, you obviously don't daven. So I go to shul, and I'm supposed to daven, I started thinking. And this is what I thought about. I thought, you know, thank God we had a grandchild, or I think at the time my daughter was expecting. I started to say like this. I started, you know, it's really unfair what God does. It's highly irregular and very unfair, because what he does is he expects from us to rear our children, to educate them, but then once I die, I have no idea if my grandchildren are going to stay in the fold. I don't think that's fair. I said to God, why can't you at least just give me like a printout that there's going to be, you know, that these kids are going to have these kids and these ones are going to be okay. And even if one's not, I'd like to know in advance, you know. So here's my question. As I got this stick in my head, and it's a little crazy, and I got it, and it was disturbing me. And my kids know when I come in from shul and I'm like, I'm in a different closet. They know that something's brewing. So I finally we got to the meal, and this is what I said to them. I said, Chevra, I have a question for you. If God comes to you now, came to me and said, listen, Hammer, I am willing to guarantee you right now that all future Hammer generations that come out of you will remain observant, but you have to give your life right now. You have to die right now, but I will guarantee that all future generations will be observant and choose what you want. So I said to them, what would you do? This is what I said to my kids. So it's a little crazy, right? I mean, you know, it's like, it's a little nuts. And maybe I am. But this is something that I posted. And it developed into, so I told them, I know what I would do. There's no question I'd give my life. If I knew that it would guarantee, I shouldn't say there's no question because it's easier said than done. But Shaloni thought we should never know. But I imagine that I would say, take me. If I know that all my generations are sticking in, no, but I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with my life. So it's done. But many of them argued with me, as is characteristic of children. I don't know if you noticed. But it developed. And my point is that we had, and one of the things that came out when we had these conversations, usually one or two of the kids will say, you know, my friends think that you're crazy, that you discuss these things at the table. But they say to me, they say to us, my parents never discussed these kind of things around the table. Never. And I think it's a mistake. Children want substance. They want substantive conversations. They have to be made to feel to be a part of the future, and that their decisions count, and that issues are real, and that dilemmas exist, and challenges slap them in the face. And they should be made to be part of that. That's constructive. There's an interesting Gemara that all of you are familiar with. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, famous story. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuf Zayin Amud Bet says that Rabbi Yoshua had a Talmud, we all know. In that Gemara, he's actually called Yeshu. But in the other future Gemarot, he's called Oto Aish, or Acher, right? He's not referred to as Yeshu, as what we know as Jesus. And the Gemara says that Yeshu, they had an experience, they were in an inn, and he said that basically this waitress is gorgeous, and Rabbi Shua said, Masa, you know, you're sitting with your Rebbe, talking about beautiful women, it's not nice. And the truth is, today we would say, like, thank God, I mean, he's normal, right? But the Gemara says that he rejected him. And the Gemara says like this, Rabbi Yeshua was reading Kriyat Shema, Atale Kameh. So this Yeshu came in front of his Rebbe, but he was in the middle of Kriyat Shema. Savar Lekabule. So Rabbi Yeshua said, you know, as soon as I finish Shema, I'm gonna take him back. Achvile Biadei. He pushed him away with his hand, Rabbi Yeshua, because he's davening. I'm davening now. Hu Savar Midcha Dochile. So Yeshu thought that when his Rebbe pushed him aside because he was down, he said, he's finished with me. And so he left the fold. He said, that was my last chance. Here I am. I come to my Rebbe. I didn't ask him to come to me. I'm sure he had a certain ego, this fellow Jesus. And he said, nonetheless, I'm going to swallow my pride. I'm coming in front of my Rabbi Yoshua. And what he does, he pushes me away. Gamardu, I'm finished with this. Azal Zakif Levinta Vishtachavala, and the Gemara is amazing. The Gemara says that on that day Yeshu went out and he bowed down to an idol. He took on the entire rebellion. And what's amazing about this Gemara, and it might have happened, it might have not happened, I don't think that's the issue. What's amazing about this Gemara is what it demonstrates is that the entire consequences of what happened in the future with regards to this fellow and with regards to many, many issues that we have in our Jewish world today, it boils down to one thing, the lack of communication. I think the Gemara might very well be telling us that Rabbi Yoshua, idcha dochile, he pushed him away in the middle of Kriyat Shema and refused to communicate with this child. And what he should have done was, excuse me, God, I've got to deal with this guy right now, or there could be serious consequences, and so let's talk. God is willing to be put on hold sometimes, but we become so enthralled by our religiosity and by being frum, whatever that means, that we fail. We don't see the picture. We're so busy playing with the wrapping, we now never get to the present. And it's a very serious problem. I have a story that I have to share with you. It just happened to me a few weeks ago. We went up to the Golan. We took our two younger children. So our youngest boy, Kenahara, he's 12 years old. He's be bar mitzvah this year. And he's the youngest. So he's got all of the overconfidence of every single child above him. And he knows everything about everything, right? He really is a chevermon. I mean, he stayed at your house, David. He's a chevermon. And he also happens to be a strikingly good-looking fellow. I mean, he doesn't look Jewish. I mean, he's a very, very good-looking boy. And he wants to be, and he's not guy. Thank God, he's not haughty, but he says, you know, he wants to be in movies and this and that. All right, maybe. So obviously, I encourage him to daven and to put on tzitzit and to daven with his abba, etc. So we went up to the Golan, and there was an area which will go unnamed, not only because I don't want to say it, but I also forgot it, actually. And it happened to be that they had, in this town, actually now I remember, but in this town, there was a large Haredi community there. A very large Haredi community there. It's not Tzfat. And and in the morning, we stayed at a tzimmer up north. In the morning, I said to this really boy, I said to him, you know, come on, let's go to shul. It's Kriyat Torah. You come with Abba. It'll be only. It won't be long. And because he's unspilled, because you know how long is it going to be? So, excuse me. The night before, listen to this. The night before, we had driven right by this area, and I said, let's go chop. You know, Mincha Mariv. We can go get Mincha quickly. And he said, okay, I'll go with you, Abba. Now, obviously, he's in his tiyul clothes, right? So, because we just come from a tiyul, and, you know, he doesn't look, he's not dressed in his best, you know, Sunday's best, and he's got a sleeveless shirt. I think they even call them, by the way, wife beaters, which is like, that's like insane. You talk about bad education. But anyway, so he's wearing this wife beater, and I go in with him to Mincha, and he says to me, and as we go into Mincha, and he's completely innocent, and he's coming to Daven Mincha, and we go into Daven Mincha, and he says to me, you know, Abba, they're looking at me. I said to him, no, it's really, boy, don't worry, they're not looking at you, I'm telling you, it's in your imagination. We're just going to Daven, they're happy you're coming to Daven, why would they be looking at you? He said, Abba, I feel uncomfortable, I think they're looking at me. I said, no, they're not, don't be prejudiced, it's not nice. I said, come Daven, and we'll go out, it's only 10 minutes. So we dive in 10 minutes and we leave. And he tells me, again, the car, he tells my wife, because, you know, my wife is always right, and then my wife will give it to me, you know, my head. So he says to my wife, he says, you know, they were looking at me. She says, I said, no, Gabby, they weren't looking at me. It's Beseda. In the morning, I said, come, Suli, we'll go to Tfilat, to Kriyat Torah, same place, we'll go dive in there, 5 minutes away. You see? So he said, no, come on, Suli, come. Finally, he put on his wife beater. He's ready for davening. It's like a gartel, you know. And he agrees to come. And my wife had told him, which, by the way, halachically speaking, I was wrong, because I should have been sensitive to the fact that you don't go in the sleeves. It's not nice. And also, you go into a Haredi place. So be respectful of the dress code. And that was my fault. I was wrong. And my wife had even said to him, because she's more sensitive and smarter than me, she said, you know, put on a T-shirt with sleeves. You know, it's not. And he chose not to. But I didn't know that they had that conversation. So I'm going, I'm proud of him. He's coming to daven Shacharit. It's Kriyat HaTorah. It's even longer davening. So we go in there, and at least three people came over to me and said, "Titbayesh, ta miviat ben shulcha kacha letfilah. Lo hayti mitbayesh laviat ben shuli kacha. You should be embarrassed. I would never bring my son to daven like this." And they're looking at him, and they really were looking at him. And I saw, and I said to myself, and then it happened. He started to cry. And he said, I'm not davening. I said, I understand. You'll stand outside the door, so you're not too embarrassed. I'll stand next to you, and we'll just daven by the edge. And as soon as Abba's finished, we'll go, we'll leave. And even right after we heard Kriyat Torah in a different minyan, we were able to chop. I went into the big shul where no one was there, and we davened together there. It was such an uncomfortable experience for him. And I said to the guy, when he said that to me, I said, but Chosot, I mean, he's coming to daven. Isn't that a good thing? I mean, his 12-year-old kid doesn't have to come to daven. To them, yes, but to him, no.
And I said, is that a good thing? I mean, he wakes up in his vacation at 7:30 in the morning to come daven in minyan and to hear Kriyat Torah. I mean, that's a good thing, no? And they said, so go tell a kid like that, you know, that he should be religious. I mean, really. I mean, you know, it made him so uncomfortable. I had to undo the damage of what was going on. But we become enthralled with our religiosity at the expense of our children. And that's unacceptable. And then I'll tell you another story. When our daughter, who's now 23 and available for a shidduch, it's never bad to throw a pitch. My wife better not hear this recording, she'll kill me. So when our daughter, our 23-year-old, when she was 15 years old, I remember that she once left a note for me on my pillow. And the note said like this. She said, "Dear Abba, I want you to know I'm too embarrassed to come speak about this with you personally, and so I'm writing this down on the note. I want you to know that there are times when I wonder whether or not God exists. And when I wonder whether or not God exists, I believe that I am not a religious person." So I left her a note on her knapsack, on her book bag, and I said, Artika, and I said, "Dear so-and-so, when you come back from school, we'll discuss this further. I'm happy to talk to you about it. It's not a problem." When she came back, I said to her, "You know," I said, "if you are someone who's wondering whether or not God exists, you are a deeply religious person. You're not religious. You're very religious. Because how many people walk around wondering whether God exists bichlal?" But the point is, there has to be communicate in a family structure. There has to be the ability to communicate about real issues openly and discuss them. And I make the following points with regards to that, because it segues into the following issue. It's an amazing thing. Meir Vollman could not have picked a better parsha, a better week to invite me to speak than this week's parsha. This week's parsha of Ki Teitzei LeMilchama Aloyvecha, the Torah talks about a child called a Ben Sorer Moreh. I mean, it worked perfectly. I had nothing else to speak about, but this works well. The Torah tells us the Ben Sorer Moreh, it's an unbelievable thing. By the way, to this day, the issue of off the derech, which you hear in English very often, that they've left the fold, off the derech, it comes from this child. Sar min haderech, ben sorer umore. Lasur min haderech means to go off, to go astray from the regular paved path. And this child did so. And sure enough, it's interesting, the Torah tells us as follows. The Torah says in Parsha, in Perek Chof Aleph, Pasuk Chof, as follows. Ve'amru el zikneiro, listen to this. The parents grab this child who's rebellious, which we'll get to in a moment of more analysis, and they say, Beneinu zeh sorer umore, this child is a rebellious child. Einenu shomea bekol avi, bekoleinu, sorry, einenu shomea bekoleinu, zolel v'sule. He does not listen to our voices. Now listen to what the Gemara darshins, listen to what the Gemara says based on this, einenu shomea bekoleinu. The child does not listen to us, the parents say. The Gemara says, haya echad mehem chiresh, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, eino nase ben sorer umore. This whole parsha, by the way, is one of the craziest things in the Torah. Listen carefully. The Gemara says that if one of the parents of this rebellious child is deaf, lo aleinu, he cannot be a rebellious child. So what's the question? What is whether or not the parent is deaf? What does that have to do with whether or not the child can be a rebellious child? It's ridiculous. Yeah? Doesn't make sense. So I saw a commentary that explains as follows. When the Gemara says, "Aya achad mehem chiresh," it doesn't mean that they are physically impaired. It means that the parent themselves are the type of person who is a chiresh. They're not listening to their child. They're not attentive to what that particular child needs. And therefore, by the Gemara's terms, they are deemed deaf.
But if it guarantees that if the parent themselves are not attentive and are not listening and are not focused on what their child needs, then the child himself, of course, will also be someone who is enenu shomea bekolenu. He doesn't listen to us. Why should the child listen to you if you are not listening to him? I'll give you a typical example where this exhibits itself in Eretz Yisrael. It's unbelievable. It's everywhere. It's rampant. It drives me out of my mind. I was a Ram, a Rebbe, in many yeshivot here, including yeshivot that's there. So I'm a Draga, yeshivot that's there. I'll tell you what the story is. How many schools do you go to that the Rebbeim will say to the students, Chevret, you b'sheket, they go to an auditorium, there's a big, tekes, or there's some kind of guest speaker, or a guest project, or play, school play. Chevret, you b'sheket, and the kids sit down, they tell them to all be quiet. The teachers go to gravitate to the back of the room, have their telephones, and they start schmoozing. So I'm like, I don't get it. I mean, you just told your students to be quiet, and you go to the back and start schmoozing. So, mayase ha'adam shelo yechata. How can you expect a child to be quiet and sit attentively if you yourself are going to schmooze with your peers? I've seen rabbanim, and I've told them in the yeshiva that I used to teach in, where the Rosh Yeshiva will get up and speak in front of the yeshiva, in front of the Beit Midrash. And what do the rabbanim of the yeshiva do? It's unbelievable. They open a Gemara, they open a different sefer, and they're learning while the Rosh Yeshiva is up there speaking. So, like, I don't get it. If the Rosh Yeshiva is giving a message that's not valuable to you, and that you don't respect or feel it's worthwhile listening to, why should your students tune in and listen to what they're supposed to listen to? It's unbelievable. So it's a tremendous hypocrisy that exists. And that's exactly what this parish says. The commentary says the foundation, the beginning of foundation of communication is listening, being attentive to what that particular person needs. But there is also a response. Mayor invited me here this evening because of an article that I wrote. I don't know if you read the article, so I'm going to read you what I came up with as the premise of Dat Lashon, because I had to come up with something. I'm going to write this article. I need to come up with something. Where are Dat Lashon coming from? Listen carefully. Although there are many factors when considering why young people stray from the traditional path paved in front of them, family dynamics, traumatic experiences, double standards within the community, even luck cannot be discounted. A recent study by the Nishma Research Institute, which by the way is in New York, and that's a big problem because they cannot take into account what our children encounter in the army, which is a very big issue. The Nishma Research Institute found that the majority of people who leave Orthodoxy do so because of things that they read or learn which they find contradictory to what they have been taught. One major innuendo when considering this finding, in Israel the problem begins with the fact that many of the essentials which should be addressed in the religious school system are not taught, discussed, or developed. This is me writing. Principles of faith and sources regarding belief which we would consider tantamount to believing in God and to subscribing to a religious home are not examined. In Hebrew, we refer to these topics as Machshevet Yisrael, Jewish thought. And while Machshevet Yisrael is part of the matriculation exams, which you all know as Bagrut, in religious high schools, the material is conveyed for the sole purpose of passing an exam as opposed to internalizing and at least engaging in a spiritual quest of conviction. It is only years later, when and if students attend pre- or post-army religious institutions, that they begin to analyze and deliberate on many of these fundamental questions and sources. But by then it is too late for many who are dissatisfied and uninterested. In fact, considering the sophistication of our children today, many of the topics of Machshevet Yisrael, Jewish thought, should already be introduced in primary school. Merely telling our children to put on tzitzit and to open the siddur may not be sufficient without discussing with them how to relate to an all-powerful authority called God, and why even when he is out of sight, he should not be out of mind. There are basic composites of knowledge that we require all children, sophisticated and less sophisticated children alike, to learn and know by a certain age, such as 2 plus 2 equals 4 in math. And I'm not good at math, is that correct? Or I before E except after C. Those are the only two things I remember from school, by the way, so I have to put them in the article. In English, why should Jewish thoughts be treated any differently? I recall sitting next to a non-observant Jewish entertainer in Australia who said to me that Judaism is undoubtedly the most authentic religion. And he was not religious. When I asked him why, he said, because it is the only religion which promotes questioning God's existence in order to strengthen one's commitment to him. We would be hard-pressed to say that this remains an outstanding characteristic in the Israeli Orthodox world of today. It is important to note that there are datlashim who believe in God but reject his Torah. And while their challenges may sound different, they are part of the same problem. They do not understand why Gentiles who want to be Jews have to go through the grueling process of conversion. Or why homosexual relationships are an abomination if this was the way God created these particular people. From an Orthodox perspective, the questions of these datlashim are even more upsetting because it appears that they firmly believe in God. But many of the prevalent issues of today, which continue to fester within the confines of the Orthodox community and Jewish law as it applies to modern society, are left alone and continue to remain taboo and unclear. Part of the reason why schools do not explore more inquiry is not only because the curriculum doesn't call for it, but also because many teachers and educators are afraid of it. They are simply not prepared to tackle the issues and engage the students. When was the last time you heard a religious educator or a rabbi pose questions such as, does God really exist? Or what are some of the ways that we can prove he does? Or for that matter, what gives humans the right to slaughter animals for the sake of eating them? I propose that the study of Machshavat Yisrael should become a staple of rabbinic training and religious studies certificates and degrees. After all, there are more Jews walking around today wondering whether God exists than those wondering whether or not a chicken is kosher. We must legitimize their quandary through knowledgeable debate and discourse. Some might voice concerns that this proposal only addresses the academically inclined individual. But what of the less intellectually curious person? Perhaps they are just tired and would be uninterested in sound intellectual argumentation. Perhaps they are simply looking for an unrestricted lifestyle. This may be true, but it is all a matter of strategy and approach. Even a non-academic child is equipped with the basics of math and reading. Orthodox and religious education needs to figure out a way by which searching and discussing God is as fundamental and age-appropriate as reading and writing. This way, not only less students will choose alternative lifestyles, but even those who do so may still want to affiliate with certain levels of observance and with a religious and may still embrace certain doctrines of faith. I was recently conversing with a religious friend of mine whose child is no longer observant, and he posed the following poignant question. Were our children, for some reason or another, brought up in a different faith other than ours? Would they naturally find their way back to what we believe and preach are the truths of orthodoxy? If we are unsure whether the answer is yes, then there is a deficiency, and we have some serious planning to do. Now, these are very serious, what I believe, very serious issues to consider. And when one asks, what about the child who's not intellectual and who's not academically inclined and who's not prepared to discuss theology? It reminds me, last week, our gardener in Beit Shemesh, he's a nice fellow, lives in Yerushalayim, so he came by and he's fixing it. I seem to remember him once telling me that he went to a yeshiva tichonit, that he went to a religious yeshiva high school. So I said to him, you know, tell me something. I said, you were once religious. You were once observant. He said, yes, yes. I'm from a dati family, and I was once dati, and I went to yeshiva dati, and now I no longer. I said, listen, I got to give a lecture next week for this fellow, Mayor Volman, who's never met me before, and I don't want to let him down, and I have no idea what to say. So tell me, from my perspective, I don't mean in any way to disgrace your thoughts, but I said, what went wrong? He said to me, I just, it just doesn't do anything for me. So I got to see my friends. I want to drink a little bit. I want to relax. I want a disco. I want to have a good time. And the only day I could do it is Shabbat. So just, you know, what can I do? It just doesn't work out on my schedule. I met a woman, by the way, recently. I kid you not. A woman recently in the United States of America, she told me, listen, Rabbi, I'm a very religious person, but I keep Shabbat on Tuesday because that's a day that works much better. It was unbelievable. You know, maybe we should implement that here. You know, everyone chooses the Sabbath day that they want. And then, you know, but he told me, it's Pashut Lo Bali. And then he says, Shum davar lo mashachoti. Nothing really piqued my curiosity with regards to Judaism. And it should be noted, by the way, that his father today is not observant either. He told me my father also left the path. So I'm just saying there's something there. Ze omer darsheni. So what's the answer? So I make the following 2 points. Mayor, right? And we have time, or you want to? Yeah. We have time.
Yeah, just keep going.
Just keep going until you knit your sweater.
Yeah.
We'll be here for about 12 hours. If your wrists get tired, pass it to someone else. Otherwise, we'll never finish.
This is for your soldiers.
I thought maybe boots for my little granddaughter.
I'll do that too, if you like. Stop.
So I'll give you the following 2 points that I believe are extremely important. Number one, what do you say to a child or a fellow who says that I'm just low poly? I'm just not interested. There's a fascinating insight that Rav Shlomo Aviner points out in his Sefer Tal Chermon. He says that if you look at the Haggadah Shel Pesach, the Passover Haggadah that we have the four sons, there are all these guys, and you look at what it says to the She'enu Adeli Shol, the child who does not know what to ask. And you look at the Torah's context, in the context of the Torah, the psukim, the response that we give to this child who does not know to ask, is the same response the Torah gives to the Rasha, to the wicked son. And the question is rather obvious. You know, I get it. I mean, a child who's not asking questions, okay, he's not the greatest student, he's not the prized academic, but to compare him to a Rasha, to say that he's wicked, It's very unfair, very judgmental. And Rav Aviner says a tremendous thing. He says, a child who does not ask questions is not wicked, but he's on the way to becoming a rasha. Because, says Rav Aviner, we in Judaism do not expect to have answers to everything. That's impossible. But there's no such thing as neutral Judaism. Judaism is not a spectator sport. It is an active, participatory experience. And therefore, if you're not asking questions, there's something wrong. And so I have to tell you, we need our children to experience Judaism. It disturbs me greatly when I hear about shuls that have done away with anim zmirot because it's just an extra. The truth is, I don't even know what anim zmirot means. And I don't even say it. But I love it. Why do I love it? I don't say it. I love it because it gives my kid an opportunity to do something in shul. And as far as I'm concerned, any opportunity I can give to my child to do in shul, that must happen. So I try to make shul, which could be a very boring experience, even for an adult, as you all know, I try to make shul experiential. And by the way, that's why we have this Karlbach craze. The Karlbach craze is not only a testament to the great music of Shlomo Karlbach, the Karlbach craze is a testament to hyperactivity. People are just tired of sitting around and listening. So come on, let's dance, let's jump, let's sing, let's clap, let's tambourine, let's guitar, or whatever it is that gets me active. Just keep my juices flowing, man, because I'm dying here. That's what Karlbach davening is. And I don't like Karlbach davening. I like the old classic songs. But I love it because it gets kids engaged. We gotta get kids engaged. We got to keep them active. So I'm blessed. I'm a Levi. I consider going out, washing the Kohanim hands, an experience for my kid.
He's always moving. I move him out to wash the hands. I move him back with my talus, cover him with my talus. Then I move. Then by the end of davening, he says, "Okay, Abba, I'm going out." No problem, later. But he's stuck around the whole davening. I move him over to the Sefer Torah to kiss the Torah. I move him over to walk the Torah back. I move him over to kiss the Torah when it's going back. I move him over to say on his mirot on Friday night. He has the opportunity sometimes to daven Kabbalat Shabbat. He feels part of it, and that's just holding him on by a thread. Judaism has to be experiential. To the person who's not academic, to the person who's not a theologian, it has to be experiential. That's what it's supposed to be. And that's why it's interesting. I segue into the following thoughts. And with this we'll conclude. Number one, the Torah, when it describes this ben sorer umore, it says, ki yelish ben sorer umore, you have this rebellious child, enenu shomea b'kol aviv b'kol imo, v'yisru oto. V'yisru oto, Rashi says, what is v'yisru oto? By the way, it's spelled with a samech. Sim lev. Spelled with a samech. Rashi says, what is v'yisru oto? So Rashi says that it means that you bring him in front of a bet din, a court, Jewish court, and you give him hatra'ah. You warn him about what might happen to him if this path continues. Which, by the way, is not a good idea in education, to a certain extent. Right, you don't like tell them, listen, you continue this way, you're doomed. You know, I mean, it's not a very good formula for success either. But whatever it is, you give him warning that he should behave differently. Fine, that we have to do to our kids. We have to give them warning and say, listen, we'd expect more. This is inappropriate, so on and so forth. The problem is that the word hatra'a, to warn someone in front of a Beit Din, is spelled with a... Help me out, because I got to drink some water. Hatra'a is spelled with a tough. Not with a samech. So v'yisru oto should not really mean warning. I actually think yisru oto is more appropriate to be connected to the Hebrew word yisurin, to experience pain. The child, v'yisru oto, they have caused him to experience a painful Judaism. Judaism, Yahadut, is painful for this child. He doesn't see the beauty. He doesn't see the fun. He doesn't see the advantage. He doesn't see the pluses that it's going to add to his life. He doesn't see the eccentricity. He doesn't appreciate it. They've caused him suffering and pain. So then what happens? Eventually you're going to bring him in front of Beit Din and there's going to be a big problem because the child is not interested. And then there's a second thing. And that's as follows. Listen carefully to what the Torah says. The Torah says, and this is from Rav Shamshul Feilhirsch, a tremendous thing. When the Torah introduces us to this rebellious son, listen to this. The Torah says, "Einenu shomea." You tell me what the difference is. "Einenu shomea b'kol aviv u'b'kol imo," which means what?
Doesn't listen to his father.
Doesn't listen to the voice of his father, and he doesn't listen to the voice of his mother. Then they grab him, the father and mother, they grab him together, they bring him in front of the Beit Din, and they say, "Beneinu zeh, our son, einenu shomea bekolenu." What does that mean?
Doesn't listen to our voice.
Says Rosh Hashanah verse, what am I wrong? At the beginning, it says in the Torah that he didn't listen to the voice of the father and the voice of the mother. Separate units. And at the end they come together, he didn't listen to us. The Rashar here says it's as follows. There's a very serious problem. The entire episode, the premise of this child becoming rebellious was because the parents had two distinct voices. They weren't on the same page. They didn't see eye to eye with regards to how exactly we should rear and nurture this child. So much so that the child was getting dichotomous messages and therefore suffered the consequences. It is only when the parents grab the child and say, "Our child has rebelled, he's a rotten kid," then it says, "Bekolenu." They're in unison when it comes to convicting the child, when it comes to saying, "We give up." That they both declare in unison. But when it came to educating the child at the beginning, they were two distinct voices. Parents, and God knows, my wife will tell you 100%,
can disagree, but you got to at some point be on the same page. You got to at some point subscribe to the same program. Otherwise, it just doesn't. And I have to tell you, there's a phenomenon going on in our community today. I see it all over the place. It's unbelievable. Observant children marrying non-observant children. There's tons of weddings like this going on. It's amazing. I've seen 3 or 4 in the last few months of people that I know. And I'm wondering to myself, how exactly, in fact, I teach chatan classes in Tarat HaMishpacha, and I've had some of them come my way, and I don't want to be rude, but I'm thinking to myself, how is this going to work? I don't know. At some point, you got to be on the same page. Otherwise, the child is getting contradicting messages, and that cannot work. It can only be destructive, certainly not constructive. And the final message is as follows. Rav Hirsch, oh, by the way, I just want to mention this, it's very important. Rav Hirsch says that parents have to be on the same page. I want to quote you what he says. Listen to this. He says, Rak az, if the parents are on the same page, Rak az, only then, Yecholim lomar, the parents can say, Shelo heim ashemim bekilkelat banam. It's an unbelievable statement. Only then can they then declare that they are not guilty of destroying their child. Now, I don't know if you appreciate what he's saying. What he's saying is what I started off with, that there are no guarantees. Because you can have parents who are on the same page and who have beautiful chinuch and education and guide their child and subscribe and so on and so forth, and it's a beautiful experience, and the child just doesn't, is just not interested. He becomes not observant. But what Hirsch says is that if they are on this, only when they're on the same page and subscribe to a certain focused plan, only then can they declare if the child is still not religious, that it's not necessarily completely their fault. And the final thing I want to finish with is a word of encouragement. The entire episode of Ben Sorero Moreh, this child who's rebellious, is one of the most challenging, if not strangest, chapters in the Torah. And I told the Chayilim today, I spoke about it today in one of the bases, I said, you know, if somebody came along who's not Jewish, who's not religious, observant, and read this parsha of Ben Sorero Moreh, they'd say, there's no way that I'm being part of this religion. It's a nutty, crazy religion. Because what it does is, it says that you take a child who has not yet lived his life, and you basically say, you know what, he's not going to make it, so we're going to kill him before he becomes really bad. It's so, excuse me, it's such an insane concept, because Judaism says, "Ein danin et ha'adam ela ba'asher hu sham." The entire Rosh Hashanah laning that we read in the Torah is about that we judge a child or judge a person according to where they are now, not according to what they will be. Because only God knows that. But here the Torah says, stone the child because of what he will become. And because of that, listen carefully, the Gemara says, according to the Rabbanan, Rabbi Yochanan argues, he's a dat yachid, he's the only one who does. This is largely, predominantly, the voice of the Chachamim, they say. Ben sorer umoreh lo haya, there never was a child like this, velo la'atid lihiyot, there never will be a child who fits this bill. So the Gemara asks, v'lama nichtav? So why does the Torah tell us all the detail? Why write it? Drush v'kabel schar, so that we can learn from it. So now the obvious question is, what are we supposed to learn from it? Right? And here's what I think. I'm going to answer that question with the following story. I have 2 brothers. All 3 of us learned in yeshiva, in Yeshivat Hezder here in Eretz Yisrael. A very good yeshiva, serious yeshiva. My oldest brother is and probably remains and the most serious of all of us. He's the oldest child. I'd say he has issues. And that's just a joke. But he's a very serious guy. He's committed. He's stringent. He keeps according to schedule. He adheres to what has to be done. And it's impressive. And when he was learning in yeshiva, he was a very serious learner. He was v'igita bo yomam v'layla. He had hatmada. He was a serious learner. He was consistent. And he had a friend who was a friend who grew up with us, by the way. We grew up in Muncie. This guy, the whole family, our families are very close. Excuse me. And this friend of his was his roommate and his chavruta in yeshiva. And my brother describes this guy as being the greatest matmid that ever was in yeshiva. He would sit day and night over books, studying, never left the Beit Midrash. Mamash, and a very bright guy. And after his second year in yeshiva, left it all. Left it all. And it was heartbreaking, not only to my brother and all of his chevra, his friends. We knew about it because it was in our community. And it was almost unheard of at that time that kids just, you know, gave up everything. It was a shanda, we call it, right? And all of our parents knew, and the parents' friends, and we were so upset. And here's a bright guy, and he had so much promise for the Jewish future, and here he left. Ah, it's a terrible. It was painful. The guy married a girl, thank God a Jewish girl. That was a concern. She knew absolutely nothing. Not even like conservative in the United States. Not even like maybe a small link to some tradition. Nothing else. And time flies by. And about 5 years, 4 years ago, they sent their son. The son went to Israel on this conservative group trip. He said, yeah, it was a good place. It's a nice place, Israel. So he started getting interested, and he had a cousin who was learning here at the same time, and he came to us for Shabbat, and he said, you know, I kind of like it. It's like, it's interesting. So Shabbat, and he went to a program by Isha Torah, and he started to get interested. He didn't become observant at that point. He started to get interested. Goes home. He goes to the University of Arizona, where my middle brother is a professor. And my middle brother is he's out there in the boondocks, middle of the desert in Arizona, and he's a religious fellow, observant fellow. So he made a connection with him over there. So they had a connection on Shabbat, they'd see each other, he'd come to shul with him, etc. Meanwhile, they're living in New Jersey, and this woman who knows nothing about Judaism, she starts getting interested. And she starts affiliating to the Chabad, the local Chabad, and she starts exploring, and yeah. To make a long story short, she, who knew nothing, has become observant. Her kids, she tells me, she's coming for Shabbat in a few weeks. She tells me, you know, she says, what kind of dress should I wear? I want to make sure that I'm dressed modestly for the, you know. I said, yeah, it's okay. She said, I don't wear those things anymore. I'm like, you know, she's like, I said, I hope you fit into our house because, whatever it is. But the point is, you know, she's like telling, and her daughter now is studying in Eretz Yisrael. For a 6-month program in Yerushalayim called Jew Essence. I don't know how they come up with these names. And they're all becoming religious. The daughter was by me 2 weeks ago for Shabbat. She saw in this Jew Essence program only sort of like the Haredi Kirov world. She said, you know, you guys are pretty cool. Like, you know, you do normal things. I could deal with this kind of orthodoxy. So she said, I'm gonna hang with you guys. I like this orthodoxy. And she's genuinely interested. Now the whole family are all becoming interested. And the father, who's the guy who was the biggest matmid in yeshiva, now he's becoming again religious because of the fact that his wife and kids are interested. What's he gonna do? So I think that's what the Gemara is telling us. The Gemara is telling us with a ben sorer morer, if there's a child who we consider rebellious, lost, gone, sar min aderech, off the derech, dat lashim, lo haya, velo atid lihiyot. A child can always come back. In any form or fashion, we never know what the future is going to bring. And that is exactly what Chodesh Elul, this month, the Krat Rosh Hashanah, is supposed to teach us. Ben Sorer Omore, Lo Haya, V'lo Atid Liyot. We are not Nidonin Al Shem Sofo. We do not judge people according to what we know they're going to become. That's inappropriate and it's unacceptable. We judge people Ba'asher Husham by what they are now. And we must continue to have a connection, love, compassion, sensitivity with our connections, our families, our peers, our children in particular, regardless of whatever way or form or fashion it reveals itself. So So let us hope and pray that we can embrace some of these principles, that we can act upon them, that the new year is the Shana Tova that is upon us, Haba Aleinu L'Tova, should indeed accentuate these ideas, and Emir Tashem, as a result of that, we should be able to be unite as one Jewish family. May Rabbi Amenu Amen.
Amen.
I'm sure there are some questions. I am happy to take them if there are any questions. I imagine. Any questions? Yes.